My name's Frank Jones. I'm an alcoholic. Walked in tonight, and the first thing I noticed is this end of the room is colder than the rest. Can't they do something about the air in here? It's good to be here, and it's good to be sober. And I want to thank Dennis for asking me and to come here and participate at your sandlapper here. It's an honor and a pleasure for me. Dennis feels like a pen pal. He didn't worry or nothing, but I got a letter from him every week. So it wasn't bad, but I'm glad I'm here. And then they hooked me up with my hostess, Michael. And I don't know how many of you know Mike Widmer, but those of you that think he's well, he's not. You got some sick ones here in South Carolina, I got to tell you. Jesus, I sit there and I had breakfast with him this morning, had dinner with him tonight, and it's like, and it scares me. It's like looking in a mirror, for Christ's sake. I don't know. But I want to thank him for being a kind host and a gentleman and showing me that Alcoholics Anonymous works. If Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't fun, I wouldn't be here. If Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't a good time, I wouldn't be here. I'm not into suffering and pain anymore. You hear a lot of speakers come to the podium and a lot of people that share, and they say they're motivated by pain. I'm not motivated by pain anymore. I'm motivated by comfort. I like to feel good. I don't always want to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I get tired when I work. I get tired. I don't want to go to meetings. I'd rather sit home and watch reruns of Lucy or something. But, you know, by the time I get in the car and I drive to that AA meeting and I see the people I know and the guys I sponsor and I listen to Chapter 5 and the 12 Traditions read and I hear the people participate and I get to talk to a lot of old friends, by the time I leave that meeting, I feel better. So I go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings because they make me feel better. I have never come to an AA meeting and left that meeting feeling worse than when I got there. So that's why I go to meetings. I don't always want to call my sponsor. I call my sponsor Monday through Friday, every day. I don't have to call him, and sometimes it's an imposition. I may be going to lunch with somebody that's important. I may have some things to do, and I don't want to pick the phone up and call. And something funny happens by the time I dial his telephone number, and I hear that man's voice on the other end, I feel better. So that's why I call my sponsor every day. I don't call him because I'm in pain. I call him because when I hear his voice, I feel better. And I don't know why that is. I can't explain it. I don't always want to work the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's a real pain in the butt right there. Making amends to people you think owe you an amends, and if you wait long enough, they'll make amends to you. And believing in a God that I didn't believe in when I got here, and turning my life and will over to somebody, and talking about my defects of character and shortcomings, and I don't like those 12 steps. But something funny happens when I leave a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I take those 12 steps with me home, where I have a hard time doing anything that's right. But when I take those 12 steps home with my wife and my family there, or I take them to work or out on the freeway or into malls and shopping centers, I seem to feel better when I have the 12 steps and I work them in my life. I don't know why. I just feel better. So that's why I go to AA meetings. That's why I call my sponsor, and that's why I try to work the 12 steps. Is because they make me feel better. If they didn't, I wouldn't bother. The other thing I got to tell you tonight before I get started is, my mom and dad never held a gun to my head and said, Frank, we want you to drink and make an ass of yourself or we'll kill you. So I can't blame my mom and dad for me being an alcoholic. So you're not going to hear that tonight. And the sad part of it is I can't blame my wives, my kids, the job, the people I hung out with, my brothers, or anybody else. I am the reason I'm an alcoholic. When I look in the mirror, I see the problem. My problem's created between my ears, and when I drank like a pig, and then when I didn't drink, I acted like a pig. So that's all. That's just the bottom line. And, you know, that's just the way it was. I have no reason to even be an alcoholic. I mean, look at me. I don't even look like an alcoholic, for Christ's sakes. I'm dapper, all right? And, when I was growing up and I thought about people being alcoholics, I thought about you people here in Myrtle Beach. You look like alcoholics, okay? But I come from a good home, and I had loving parents, and Mom and Dad loved and cared for me and my two brothers a lot. Dad worked the same job for over 40 years, and he was married to my mom for over 50 years. And growing up, I did everything as a kid that a kid would want to do. I had a tremendous childhood. I don't even go to dysfunctional family member syndrome meetings, for Christ's sakes. I just had a great childhood. I played Little League baseball and Pony League, and I won letters in high school. I played football, basketball, and I run track. And I did all the things that kids wanted to do growing up, and my childhood was absolutely fantastic. I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started working these steps, and I did a fourth and fifth step. And You know, I look back and I found out that during high school and stuff, and even before that, I was a liar and a cheat and a thief. And I don't know where I learned that. Mom and Dad didn't teach me how to do that either. I picked that up naturally. It's just, you know, it's easier to be a liar than it is to tell the truth, so I lie. That's all. You know, you can add or subtract from the story, make it anything you want to do or anything you want to be, and it's cool. And you know, your parents, mom and dad, used to give me money to go at the store and stuff. Well, I just steal what they sent me for and keep the money. You know, you make out that way. And so I was a thief growing up also. And, you know, I didn't want anybody to know that. And the other thing growing up, all I wanted to do all my life is be a part of. I wanted to be a part of those guys that hung out together and they were a clique and, you know, they did things and I never felt like I was a part of. And, you know, I looked at those guys and those guys were macho and I wanted to be macho when I grew up. I grew up, during a macho time and, Wild Bill Hickok was in the movies and Lash LaRue and all these Wild West dudes and those guys were macho and the guys I hung out with were macho and I wanted to be a macho tough guy. Look at me. I look like Mr. Peepers. Dude is not tough, you know, and I felt inadequate and I felt like a punk and I wanted to hang out with you guys and you guys scared me. And, the other thing I couldn't tell you guys, I was a liar and a cheat and a thief because you wouldn't like me. And, so I had to keep those secrets from you. And the other thing was in high school even, I was afraid of the dark. And macho guys ain't afraid of the dark, but I couldn't tell anybody I was afraid of the dark. So I had to stuff those things down inside me and as a result of that, when guys got too close to me or scared me, I had to become a fighter. And, because they scared me. And when I get scared, I react to fear with physical violence. And, I don't know where I got that from, but that's the way it was without ever taking a drink. And, you know, in Danville, Illinois, growing up, I'd go to school and I'd do that, and the guys would scare me, and after ball practice or something, I'd go hang out down on Main Street in Danville. And in Danville, there, the guys when I was growing up, they had ducktail haircuts, and they had long sideburns, and they wore black leather jackets with those zippers and doodads all over them and stuff, and they wore oily engineer boots, and these guys carried zip guns and switchblade knives and bicycle chains, and, these guys were macho dudes, man, and, I hung with those guys and it was an adrenaline rush and I couldn't let them know I was afraid of the dark and I was a wimp and a wussy because I didn't want to be that. And these guys would go out on rumbles. They weren't like these punks today and these gangs. They have drive-by shootings for Christ's sakes. They can't even stop and talk to you about it. Yeah, I don't know. Out in California, they have those doggone things and we couldn't do that. We had zip guns. They only fired one round. You had to hit your target and these guys fire hundreds and hit innocent people. But, you know, we'd go on rumbles and these guys would bang people out and they'd hit them with a bicycle chain or stab them with their switchblade knife, and I'd hit some guy with a brick or a club upside the head, and I felt sorry for him. Macho guys don't feel sorry for guys when they do that to them, and I did, and I had to stuff that down inside me and not tell you guys about it because you wouldn't let me hang with you, and I'd go home and worry about the guy that I hit, and, you know, I just felt like a wimp and a wussy, and I hated those feelings, and that's the way it was, and the older I got, the fights got worse, and all the feelings that I had got worse, and I was at a party one night with my girlfriend. It was a hot summer night in Danville, and she brought me over a big iced tea glass full of sloe gin and 7-Up, and, you know, I didn't know what that stuff was, and I took a drink of it that night, and it tastes like strawberry Kool-Aid, and that was my drink of choice back then, strawberry Kool-Aid, and so I chug-lugged it down, and, you know, you hear speakers stand up here, and they tell you they take that first drink of alcohol, and it goes down into their stomach and out to the tips of their fingers and to the tops of their hair, and they get 6'4", 220 pounds, and their pimples fall off, and that didn't happen to me. You know, I just drank it down and handed her the glass and said, go get me another one. And she did. And I drank that one down. And, you know, nothing happened. I didn't cross an invisible line on the floor. And I didn't get a bottle of wine and throw it in a paper bag and get a trench coat and go hang out on Skid Row. I didn't plan on being an alcoholic or having any of those things happen. You know why I drank? Because all the guys there were drinking. All my buddies were drinking at that party that night, and they were laughing and scratching and making out and dancing. And they were having a good time. And I felt inhibited, and I couldn't have a good time. I was so self-obsessed, and, you know, I just drank because my buddies were drinking, and I drank a gallon of that stuff in about 20 minutes. And it was no big deal. I didn't grow hair on the palms of my hand or nothing. And about 30 minutes after that last glass of Sloe Gin and 7-Up, found out where Sloe Gin got its name, got drunk as hell, went into a blackout, and I got taken home that night, and I passed out, and the next morning I come to, and I'm vomiting red stuff up all over the bedroom, and I'm sicker than a dog, and I can't figure it out, and I couldn't remember anything that had happened the night before. I couldn't remember anything, and, you know, I don't know how many of you people drank in blackouts, and I didn't even know what a blackout was back then, and, but I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys told me what a blackout was, and I didn't know, and you guys said, well, it's when you go drink, and, everything that, you're gonna do, you just go on and do it, you know, and, then the next morning when you come to, you can't remember it. And, I used to go out to movies or stuff with my wife or to a party, and she'd talk to me about it the next day, and I don't even remember going. And at the end of my, how do you lose a 4,000-pound car? I park my car, go in the bar and drink, come out, and my car's gone. And then at the end of my drinking, I'd wake up in these little sleazy hotels, and I look over next to me, and this damn thing's laying there. I don't know where in the hell I got it at. Hair's all matted down on his face. It's been marked and tagged by some animal control officer. And, that's a blackout, you see. I didn't know that. It's the kind of thing where you're sleeping and she's on your arm, you just chew it off so you don't wake her and get the hell out. And I come here to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys explained to me that that's an indication I have a problem drinking. You see, I didn't know that. And, I don't know if you had blackouts or not. Some of you that are sitting there with your husband and stuff, I think you did have blackouts, okay? No, I didn't mean that. I'm sorry. But what happened was that was a blackout, and that's an indication I had a drinking way back in high school, and I didn't know that. And I didn't file anything away. I just continued to drink and fight and get in trouble and steal and do the things that I thought I had to do to fit in, and I wanted to be macho and a tough guy. And, I had an offer to go play some basketball somewhere, and they were going to pay my way. And I don't know about you, but I have a committee that meets up here between my ears, and they even did it then. And my head says, what if you don't make that basketball team? Well, that scared me. And then it says, what if you don't make the grades to go on and play ball when you're in college? And so that scared me. And so I did what macho tough guys were doing back in Danville then. I quit high school 2 weeks before graduation. That made sense to me. And then, I did what macho tough guys do. I joined the Marine Corps. And, I found myself on a train getting ready to go up to Chicago to get sworn in. And here I'm sitting next to a guy, and I'm leaving home for the first time. And this guy's got a ducktail haircut. He's got long sideburns. He's got on that black leather jacket and oily engineer boots, and he's going into Marine Corps. And he's drinking out of a little brown bottle, and he looks at me, and he says, hey, you want a drink of this? Now I'm sitting there, and I got a flat top, and my cheater's on. I got a white crew neck sweater and my leather jacket, and I feel like a wimp sitting there. I'm scared to death. I can't tell this guy, oh, no, I don't want any of that. I'm homesick and miss Mom and Dad already. I can't say that. I want to fit in with him. I want to hang with him in Chicago. So I tell him, yeah, I'll take a drink of that. And I took that bottle, and I turned it up, and I took 3 or 4 big mouthfuls of it. Now, I don't know how any of you folks drank whiskey at the age of 17. I can tell you what happened to me, though. I threw that crap back up again all over the seat in front of me. And, I got tears running out of my eyes and snot running out of my nose. I can't breathe. This guy's looking at me funny, and I want to fit in with him. So I wiped off my face and handed him the bottle back, and I said, boy, that was good. And that's the way I was when I drank. I just wanted to fit in with whoever I was with. If I'm sitting in a country western bar, I used to tell people I was George Jones's nephew. I'm a liar. And if I'm sitting there with truck drivers, then I'm a truck driver. Hell, I can't even drive a pickup, for Christ's sakes. But I tell people that. I'm whatever I have to be to fit in because I wanted to fit in. And, I got sworn in and I ended up at MCRD San Diego, and this maniac with a funny round hat and a shaved head snatched me off that bus. And I don't know why he picked me out, but scared the hell out of me. And he called me dirty names you people here in AA don't even use. And, I went through boot camp frightened and full of fear and scared to death. And I got out of boot camp, and I'm at Camp Pendleton. And then in 1962, in October, the Cuban crisis broke out, and I'm going to go get to kill Cubans. And, that's a macho deal for me, except I'm afraid now. I'm frightened because we're going to war. We're on a ship going through the Panama Canal, and I got all these hot rocks in my stomachs and these big butterflies in there. And you guys don't look afraid at all, and I can't figure that out. And I feel like a wimp again because you guys ain't afraid and I am. And some of my buddies broke into the narcotics locker on that ship down there, and they brought me a morphine syringe down to me. And they told me where I could stick it, and I did. And I went up on the deck of the ship that night, and I laid out there all night looking at those stars, and I was cool. I was slick, snapping my fingers, and I had it together. And if you'd have walked up to me that night and said, hey, Frank, we know why you're not afraid no more, I'd have said, yeah, so do I. I grew up all of a sudden. I matured. And I didn't know back in 1962 what I know tonight here in South Carolina. I didn't know that if I inject narcotic into my system, it'd take fear away. I didn't know if I injected a narcotic into my system, it'd allow me to act cool and put a facade out there I thought you guys would like and be slick. I didn't know any of those things, and I didn't file that away. And I didn't use any more narcotics after that either. It's hell, it don't take any talent to be a dope fiend, for Christ's sakes. Anybody can be one of those. And, think about it. If you're going to be if you fill up a syringe with a narcotic substance and inject it into your vein, you're going to become addicted to it. I don't know any social heroin users. You snort cocaine, you become addicted to cocaine. I don't know any social coke users. But if you're going to be an alcoholic, you got to work at it. You got to hang in. You can't drink one beer and get here, have a shot of whiskey and say, well, I better go to AA. So you got to hang in. You got to have no pride, Just think about it. You got to start drinking and stuff, and you got to start spending a lot of money on booze, and you got to go out and hang out in the bars or at home, and yelling at the old lady and blaming her for everything, or blaming your old man and yelling and screaming at the kids, and then hanging out at the bars and, you know, starting to throw up and stuff, and you go at the bathroom and come out and you wet down the front of your trousers. That's macho, you know. You feel like a real champ when you do that. And, you know, you sleep in the bushes and you go to jails and you go to nut houses, and you got to do that one day at a time for years, for Christ's sakes. You know, you just can't be an alcoholic. You got to work at it and not let looking bad bother you. But anyway, that's what I am. I'm not a dope fiend, so I didn't use any more dope after that. And we didn't get to kill Cubans, and we went back through the Panama Canal, and I ended up in Okinawa. And in Okinawa, all my problems started. And the first night over, the guy says, "Hey, Frank, let's go get drunk." And I said, "Let's go." And I went out with these five or six Marines to get drunk, and we bought a Typhoon Fifth of sake. It held about 2 gallons. It cost us 75 cents. And these guys are standing out there, and we start passing that bottle around. And I'm with the men, see, and I feel macho. And that bottle gets to me, and I turn it up. It looks like water. And so I took 3 or 4 big mouthfuls of it. And, you know, I don't know how you drank sake at the age of 17, but I took 3 or 4 big mouthfuls, and I threw that crap back up again all over their shoes. I got the tears and the snot running out of my nose. These guys are laughing and pointing at me. And that's what I mean. If you're going to be an alcoholic, you can't let looking bad bother you. And, you know, I said, "Give me that bottle back." And I took that bottle. You know, I turned that bottle back up again, and I threw it up again. And I thought, "God, you'll never make it to Myrtle Beach at this rate. And you're going to have to do something." And so, you know, I drank some more, and I threw it up. And I drank enough of it, and I kept holding a little bit down each time. And something finally happened. That stuff went down into my stomach. And I stood there looking at those 5 or 6 guys I was with, and I realized something. Those guys were punks. I didn't need those guys. I was macho. And so I left, and I went out on my own, and I'm drinking in the bars there in Okinawa and shooting pool, and a Marine said something that offended me, and so I smacked him with a pool cue in the mouth. And, you know, that's what macho guys do. And you know the feeling you get when the police are looking for you? Well, I got that feeling, and I split from the bar, went down to another bar. I'm down there drinking, and a little Nissan sidles up to me, and, well, we strike a deal, and I give her a couple of bucks, and we trudge the road of happy destiny down to her hooch. And, you know, I'd like to stand up here tonight and tell you what a big night that was for me. But 17 years old and drunk, I'm not going to lie to you, because I'm not going to fly back here and make amends to you, all right? But as a courtesy to me, she went to clean up. And when she did, that hurt my pride and my ego. And so I stole my money back and set her house on fire. Made sense to me. And, you know, on my way out, I stole her pearls and kimonos and pawned them and went back to the base and passed out. And that was my first night of drinking overseas. And, you know, I come to the next morning at Reveille, and I had that terrible headache, and I was vomiting, and I was sick at my stomach, and I could hardly open my eyes. The light hurt my eyes. And the guy started telling me about hitting that Marine with a pool cue, and the MPs were looking for me. And I got that fear in my stomach, and I got that anxiety, and I had that feeling inside, and it was just fear is what it was. And I got scared, and they told me about setting that woman's house on fire, and I thought, I didn't remember any of that stuff. And, you know, my dad didn't treat my mom that way. Where did I pick that up at? And you know, I was scared to death, and I was sicker than a dog. And, you know, I opened my locker that morning, and there was a bottle with a red dot on it, and it was Akadama wine. And I took that bottle of wine down at 5 o'clock that morning, and I uncapped it, and I took 3 or 4 big mouthfuls of it. And I didn't throw it up. And I drank some more, and I went out to formation. I come back, I drank a little bit of water and some more wine, and something funny happened. I quit throwing up, and my headache went away. My stomach settled down. And someplace it must have been in the back of my mind that said, "You know what, Frank, if you drink in the morning, you can go out and get drunk as you want, and you're not going to feel sick in the morning." And then something about 20 minutes later happened. I started to brag about hitting that guy with a pool cue. I started to brag about setting that woman's house on fire. You see, I like that recognition. You see, alcohol took the feelings of guilt away. Alcohol took the feelings of remorse away and the anxiety that I was feeling. And I started to brag about that stuff. And someplace in the back of my mind, my head says, "You know what? You can go out and do anything you want to. You have found an answer to all that stuff." And that didn't consciously happen, but it must have happened somewhere in my mind, because I became a morning drinker and a daily drinker after that. And I became a bar fighter, because that's what macho guys do. And hell, I'm too light to fight and too thin to win. So I had to develop the technique of ambush, and I did that. And, you know, the Marine Corps frowns on those actions, though. And I started getting office hours and court martials and making rank and losing it. And, you know, if you'd have told me alcohol did that, I'd have said, "You're crazy. Alcohol ain't got anything to do with that." And, you know, I just blamed them. It wasn't me. It was never me. And, you know, I was getting busted and making rank. And you tell me if it sounds like I got a problem drinking. You know, you're alcoholics in here. And I don't think I got. I'm sitting in a bar drinking, and I'm drinking and drinking sake and Asahi beer and some Suntory whiskey. And little Nason says, "Buy me a drink," and I do it. And before she drinks it, I taste this tea. Now, she's trying to rip me off. And so I threw her shot glass through the mirror. Does that sound like I got a problem drinking? Hell, if it wasn't Tia, I wouldn't have thrown it through the mirror. And then Mama Son says, pay for the mirror. And I tell her what she can do with the mirror. And then they call the MPs, and the MPs come in, and they tell me to pay for the mirror. So I tell the MPs what they can do with the whole bar. And does that sound like I got a problem drinking? No, I don't have a problem drinking. And so then the MPs handcuff me. Now, I'm claustrophobic. I hate that. And so I got to try to fight the MPs, handcuffed. And then they take me back to my base, and the duty NCO tells me to shut up and go hit the rack. Well, nobody tells me to shut up, so I smacked him. Does that sound like I got a problem drinking? No, I don't have a problem with alcohol. If he hadn't told me to shut up, I wouldn't have smacked him. And then they handcuffed me to the rack, and I dragged the rack all over the squad bay, waking people up. I don't have a problem drinking. You see, if they hadn't have served that tea to her and called it whiskey, if she hadn't have called the MPs, if they hadn't have told me to pay for it, if he, you see, all my life I could blame other people for my problems. You see, it wasn't ever me. I never looked at me as being the reason. I always looked at other people, places, things. They caused it. He did it. It was her fault, not mine. Until I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, new people told me if I wanted to see where the problem was, I needed to look in the mirror. And when I look in the mirror, I seen the problem. And I didn't know that until I came here because I could blame everybody else. And that's the way that went. And then I ended up running out of money because the cab drivers were always overcharging us. So I decided to rob one of them. And so I beat his face in with a rock the size of a softball, and he almost died. And I had a general court-martial, and my dad flew to Okinawa, and I begged the Marine Corps not to throw me out. It's the only thing I knew how to do. And some deals were struck, and to make a long story short, I was sentenced to 2 years confinement in a federal penitentiary and back to duty. And you can't do that. If you spend more than 6 months locked up, they got to throw you out. But by the time paperwork went through to get me released from that brig, I'd spent a year there. And I got out, and I went back to North Carolina, to Jacksonville at Camp Lejeune, and I met a woman and I married her, and she's 18 and I'm 19, and I want to go drink with the guys in the bars, and she don't want me to, and so we have cuss fights, and I'm drinking at home, and we're cussing at each other, and I can't fight with her because I just had a court martial for that, and so I break the furniture up, and hell, that's stupid, I paid for it, but I got to go out and drink in the bars, and out in the bars, some guy will say something, and I'll hit him with a bottle of beer, and then I got to meet a woman to validate myself because I don't feel like a man, so we trudge off to her place, and we do what her and I got to do, and when we get done, I think, why did I do that? You know, I feel that guilt and that shame you feel because, you see, my wife hadn't done anything to cause that. You see, that was me, and I felt that guilt and that shame, so I can't go home. And so I got to stop in a bar and have a shot of whiskey and a couple of beers, and, you know, the guilt goes away, and now I can go home. And I walk in the door, and what does she say? Where have you been? Now I got to lie to her, see? If she hadn't asked that question, I wouldn't have lied. And so we have the cuss fight again, and it's back out in the bars, and it's fighting, and it's another woman, and validating myself, because I always needed to be validated, because I didn't feel like a man. And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys tell me I'm too immature to be a husband. I didn't know that. You know, I didn't know. All I wanted to do is be a husband the way my dad was a husband to my mom. That's what I wanted to do, but, you know, she didn't do things right, and it was her fault, and I didn't know that I had the problem, that you guys told me that it's none of my business how she dresses or how she takes care of the house or what she cooks for dinner or when we have sex or how or anything else. And I'm just to shut up and mind my own business and not tell her what to do. And I thought, that'll never work. She's only 18. Who in hell will tell her if I don't? You know. And you guys told me to just shut up and leave her alone and I'm just to take care of me. And I didn't know that. Then we have a daughter and I don't know how to treat kids. And, you know, kids cry and they make messes and they wet their diapers and crap their diapers and get it on the wall in the crib. And, you know, it makes me crazy because I like things perfect and everything. And so I'd yell at the kid and I'd shake it and it wouldn't quit crying. I'd throw it in the crib and then she'd yell at me. And so then her and I'd have a cuss fight and I got to go back out in the bars and drink. And so I'm out there drinking and some guy'd come up and now I'm carrying a gun because guys are scaring me. So I cock it and put it in your face. And now you don't scare me no more. And that's cool, and it backs you off, and so I'll smack you with a gun if you stick around. And I got to meet a woman and go to her place because I don't feel like a man again. And I go home, and it starts again over and over, and I'm on that treadmill, and I can't get off of it, and it's not alcohol. You see, it's that noise at home, and it's not quiet, and that crying kid, and the people in the bars, and, you know, it's never alcohol, and it's just other things. And finally, I got called into the CO's office one day, and they issued me a rifle with a telescope on it, live ammunition, and they sent me across the ocean to a place called Vietnam. And, you know, before I get there, I got to tell you this. Vietnam's not my problem. You see, Vietnam's not my problem. Vietnam's a 2-year part of my story's all. You know, I talk to a lot of people after meetings down south in Southern California, and, you know, they tell me, I can't stay sober, man, all the things I did in Vietnam, and I did this and that, and I tell them, no, I don't want to hear crap like that, you see. I got that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and in that book it says that if I go to meetings and I get into action, I have a conscious contact with a higher power, and that I start doing the things that's outlined in this big book, that I can stay sober no matter what, and I can be happy, joyous, and free. And I got to tell those guys, if they can't stay sober, that they're not staying sober because they don't want to. And they're using that crap over as a cop-out. That's just my opinion. You see, because Alcoholics Anonymous works, and it's worked for me for in about 1 month now. It'll be 13 years. Now, that ain't a long time. It's like Bob said, it's a long time for somebody like me. But you see, AA works. You see, and what I got right now, I don't have the past. And what I did in Vietnam is I was scared over. I was frightened, and I couldn't tell anybody how scared I was. I was a sniper, and I was up at Khe Sanh and Khon Tien, and I worked with recon, and I was scared to death, and the things I seen made me sick at my stomach, and I couldn't do those things. And you guys couldn't. I don't know how you could do that, and I didn't want you to know what a wimp I was inside. I found out a secret in Vietnam. You put 151 proof rum in your canteens, and you drink that, you become bulletproof and invisible. Yeah, I did that. Now I can go out and do the things I got to do to show you what a man I am and to show you how macho and tough I am. And I do those things and take a couple of drinks. And I don't feel no guilt and no shame from the things I did. You know, I can brag about it because you see alcohol work. And what alcohol did for me in Vietnam is save my sanity. And what it did for me in Vietnam is save my life, you see. And allowed me to do what I had to do to survive. And so I don't blame Vietnam for any of my problems. I was an alcoholic long before I went over there. You know, that's what me and Mike were talking about at breakfast this morning. My problem's me, and it's nothing that I did or anything. And what happened was, is in March of 68, I got blown up during a siege at Khe Sanh, and, you know, I came back to the States, and I still got that damn wife, and we had a son born to us while I was on Hill 881, and, you know, I want to go out drinking with the guys and be macho, and then the kids are crying, and I just come out of a noisy place, you know, I don't need that. And, you know, and the kids are crying, and she's running her mouth, and I want to go out, and she don't want me to go out, and I tell her to shut up or I'll kill her, and she don't believe me. And she keeps running her mouth, and I tell her, shut up or I'll kill you, and she don't. And I went in the closet, and I got a gun out. And you know, I don't believe in God. You see, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous prayers of God, I was screwed. I broke all 10 of the commandments before I was 20 years old. So there's no God for me, and I didn't believe in God. And I come here, and you guys say there was a God in the house that day. And I didn't believe there was. And, you know, I look back on that situation, what happened that day, and I got to tell you, there definitely was a God in the house that day. You see, I got that gun out of that closet, and I walk back into that kitchen, and I'm drinking 10 high whiskey. She's still running her mouth at me, and I can't get the safety off that gun. And, you know, my daughter's standing there, and she's crying, and she's telling me don't shoot her mommy. And that little boy that was born while I was in Vietnam's over there crying, and that house is chaotic the way an alcoholic house is, especially a violent drunk. And that safety won't come off, and I hit a spring in the back, and that spring come out, and I pushed that spring back in, and it was a firing pin, and that gun went off. And the bullet went down between my hands and went down between my legs where my daughter was standing. And the bullet didn't hit her, you see. There was a God in the house that day looking out after that little girl. See, I could have killed her accidentally. You know, I'd have shot my wife that day. I can stand here sober and tell you that. You know why? She didn't shut up. And when I told you to do something when I was drinking, you better do it. Because I got no regard for your life and very little for mine. And that's how alcohol did for me. You know, shortly after that, she divorced me. Can you believe that? I only fired one shot, you know, and she split. I didn't even fire the whole clip. And I shot myself, for Christ's sakes, you know. And I was a drill instructor, and I went on the drill field, and I was a liar and a cheat and a thief, and I stole from the recruits, and I'm not proud of that. But that's what I had to do to drink because I wasn't making enough money to drink. And, you know, I did a lot of things that I'm not very proud of when I was in the Marine Corps and when I was in Vietnam and on the drill field. But, you know, I come here, and a lot of you folks told me, you know, what you got is right now. And if I put enough of these together right now, I'm going to have it tonight. That's all. I can't put enough right nows together to have it 20 years ago. I can't go back and change anything in my past. There's a lot of things I'd like to change, a lot of things I'd like to undo, a lot of hurt I'd like to heal, and I can't do that. What I can do today is try to be an example and not act the way I used to act, and I learned that from you people. You see, because I didn't know how to act when I got here, and there's a lot of things I would like to change, but I need to stay sober right now and be okay right now, and then I'm going to have it tonight or tomorrow. That's all I know, and I learned that here. You know, I got suicidal and crazy from my drinking. I was still fighting in the bars. I was starting to pass a little blood when I went to the bathroom, and, you know, I got suicidal, and I couldn't kill myself, and so I volunteered and went back to Vietnam for a second tour, and it got a lot worse over there this time for me, and I'd done a lot more bad things to a lot of people, and the guilt and the shame were eating me up, and alcohol again saved my sanity, and it saved my life, and, you know, those are the things I was talking about that I can't change, you see. I know today that big book doesn't say anything about if you've done a lot of bad things to a lot of people, you can't stay sober. It says that you can stay sober if you do certain things, and I believe that, you see. There's nothing that I've done that I can't undo today that I can't change my actions today and be better. I come back from Vietnam, and I drank myself out of the Marine Corps after 11 years. They wanted me to come back after lunch, and I couldn't do that. You know, I had to drink. I had to have that alcohol in my system. And so I got out of the Marine Corps after 11 years, and I done what macho tough guys do when they're alcoholic. I strapped on a gun and a badge and became a police officer. And I took that out on the street with me. I took alcoholism on the street with me, and I took fear. I can't sit there. How can I tell my partner in that police car I'm afraid to go down that alley? How can I tell him there's demons down there that's going to get me, and I can't describe the demons to him? How can I tell him that I'm afraid of the dark? How can I tell him the fear I'm feeling, and that if I don't drink, I have nightmares? How do I tell him that? I'm a Vietnam vet, for Christ's sakes. I'm decorated. I fought hand-to-hand combat over there. He knows that I'm macho, and I can't tell him anything. And so before I come to work, a couple of drinks, and I'm all right. The fear goes away. But you see, something else happens when I take a drink of alcohol. If you scare me, I get violent. Everybody scared me, and so I was a violent police officer. And I'm not proud of that today either, but today, to make amends for that, I go to the institutions out there, and I'm very fortunate that I get to go speak in the prisons and the hospital, and I make my amends. And I try not to treat people that way I used to treat them. And, you know, for the most part, it works. I'm not always wonderful, and I'm a human being, and I don't even use that as a cop-out. But, you know, I try to treat people today the way I want to be treated, and, so I wasn't a very good police officer in that respect. And what happened was is, you know, I've always got to be validated. And, you know, I got married again, and we had a daughter, and then my wife got pregnant. And, you know, then I had an affair with my partner. Now, I'm from Valencia, not Hollywood, okay? And my partner was a female. And just clarifying is all, not judging. It doesn't make me any different. But my partner was a female, and she found out I got my wife pregnant, and she shot me, for Christ's sakes. That's not funny. This is the sad part right here. And you're laughing. The women always get a kick out of the other women shooting me. I like that. You some cold ladies in Alcoholics Anonymous, I got to tell you. No compassion for the male alcoholic. I've never had a break from you women. You know that? But she almost blew my head off. I have a permanent part. I don't have to worry about where it goes on my head. There's no decision to make. It's always right there. The hair just falls away from the scar. But that ended my police career after about 7 years. And you know, I did what any self-respecting drunk could do. I got a real estate license. And if you're sitting there tonight, you think money, property, and prestige will fix it for you. You think you had a lot of money and a big car and everything, you'd be okay. You wouldn't have to sit in these cockamamie meetings with the rest of these losers. I had a brand new Cadillac, and so did my wife. We had a house on a quarter acre, and I had a swimming pool installed and a 3-hole putting green, and my kids wore designer clothes, and so did my wife, and I wore custom suits, and I had gold chains and diamond rings. I had a Mr. T starter kit before he was ever on television. I got to tell you that I never sunk so low as to wear an earring, though. Now, any of you guys that are sitting out here with earrings on tonight, don't come up and talk to me about it. I apologize, okay? What you need to think about doing is give it back to your wife so she'll have a pair again, all right? That's all. No, I didn't mean that either. I'm sorry. No, I didn't mean that. Listen, I'm old and I'm not macho. Don't pick on me. I'm sensitive. And but you know, that didn't fix it for me. Nothing fixed it. I was still drinking and fighting in the bars, validating myself with other women, abusing that family, and crazier than hell at home. I'd nailed the windows shut, and I was starting to pass a lot of blood and get sick. And you know, at the age of 36 years old, I stood there and I looked around, and everything I'd worked all my life to get. You see, all my life I've wanted to be like my dad. I wanted to be like my father. I wanted to be a good man and be a father and a husband and just, you know, just have a normal. That's all I wanted was that. And I looked around, and at the age of 36, everything I'd worked for was gone. The house on the quarter acre, the wife, the two kids, the Cadillacs, the custom suits, the jewelry, everything was gone. And if you'd told me alcohol stripped me of that, I'd have said, you're crazy. Alcohol couldn't possibly have done that. Everything I owned was in a cardboard box in the back seat of a stolen car. If you'd have told me, that's a hell of a note for a police officer, isn't it? Well, any length, okay? I had to get back from Indiana, so I had to have wheels, so I stole them. It's not a problem. I had to pay for that car in sobriety. Wreckage will come up and get you when you get sober. And, you know, I looked around, and there was nothing left, and I was dying, and I didn't know it, and I was vomiting blood and passing blood, and I ended up getting taken in by a woman into her house, and I drank and ate in her closet and passed a lot of blood, and I finally went to a doctor, and he gave me a physical, and he called me back in his office, and he told me, he said, Mr. Jones, he says, the only thing I can tell you is you're an alcoholic and you're dying. And you know what I felt when he told me that? I felt relief. I was tired. Hell, I'd been busy. I'd been doing a lot of stuff. And when he told me that, and he said, if you don't stop drinking now, you're going to die. He says, you got a hole in your throat, you're hemorrhaging internally, you have cirrhosis, liver, hepatitis, and I had a lung and stomach infection, and all the things you get if you're a chronic alcoholic. And he says, you're addicted to alcohol the way a heroin addict is to heroin. And I thanked him. I said, thank you very much. And I got out to that stolen car and I drove to the liquor store and I bought a fifth of whiskey and a case of beer. You see, I had taken a gun and cocked it and put it in my mouth and I couldn't pull the trigger. And when he said, if I don't stop drinking, I'm going to die, I was so tired and desperate that I figured I'll drink myself to death. And I started drinking as hard and as fast as I could. And what happened was, is to make a long story short, I just ended up very sick. And I ended up in a hospital in Indiana, strapped down, not for alcoholism, because I was physically ill and wouldn't let people take care of me. And they strapped me down and they pumped me full of vitamin B and magnesium. And they called my wife in California and they said, we think you ought to come back to Indiana. Your husband's going to die from the DTs, we think. And you know what my wife told the doctor? Now, this is a sad... You get Kleenexes out. She said, why don't you let that son of a bitch die? I couldn't believe she said that. I just gave her about 10 good years. I'll tell you what. All right, now I know where this section's coming from, all right? This is the banana section over here. You've turned on me with a viciousness now. But I tricked her. I didn't die. And I'm still haunting her. And we'll be married 23 years this year. And that's because of God A and Al-Anon. That's not because of me, because I'm not a wonderful husband or father. It's because she goes to Al-Anon meetings and she does Al-Anon the way I do AA. And we got God A and Al-Anon in our home. And if we didn't have that, we wouldn't have a home today. And, you know, she's got a sponsor and she goes to 4 or 5 meetings a week and she speaks and she's very involved and she allows me to do AA. And I have a little more time than she does, so I help her with her program. That's the kind of guy I am. But if we didn't have God A and Al-Anon, we wouldn't have what we have today. And I didn't die. And what happened is I got out of that portion of the hospital there and all my physical ailments were cleared up. And they put me in another part of the hospital. And what they did is they made me go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that made me crazy because I walked into Maywood, Indiana, into this damn AA meeting. And it was a bunch of losers just like you. And I hated you. And you see, I was better than you. You ain't had the money I had. I was making 6 figures a year, for Christ's sake, until I lost everything. And, you know, I you didn't have what I had. You ain't been where I had been. You didn't have the cars or the jewelry. You wasn't as slick as me. And you were less than me. And I hated you. And you guys didn't care. You'd come up and slap me on the back and say, 90 meetings in 90 days. Frank, you want to go to AA? If you're going to take a drink, go to AA. Go to AA if you're going to drink. Go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I got so sick of hearing that, I wanted to break your face. I hated you. And I wouldn't even hang around. I'd hang out in the back of the room, and I hated you because you were a clique, and I'd leave there, and I'd go back to my room. The next day, I'd go back into that AA meeting because I had to, and I'd go in, and I was less than you. You see, you hadn't taken alcohol to where I had taken it. You see, you hadn't done to the things of the people in Vietnam what I did. You didn't treat people the way I did when I was a cop. You didn't treat your wives and kids the way I treated my wives and kids, and I was less than you. You see, I was either less than or better than. I couldn't find anything in the middle, and I hated you for being better than me, and I didn't want to hang with you. And you know, you guys didn't care. You said, go to 90 meetings in 90 days, Frank. If you want to drink, go to AA. And I kept hearing that crap over and over again, and it just made me crazy. And you know, I'd sit there and I'd listen to that, and I couldn't even remember the words of the Lord's Prayer. I had a speech impediment, and I walked with a limp, and I thought I had brain damage or something from Vietnam, and you guys didn't even care. Go to AA if you want to drink. And that's what I heard. And you know, I went to those 90 meetings, and I got out of that hospital, and I walked out 2 glass doors into that Indiana sun, and I stood out there, and I started crying. And I don't know what kind of alcoholics you are here in Myrtle Beach. I don't know what kind of alcoholics you are. Maybe you quit drinking and your life gets better. Maybe you put down that booze and everything is slick and wonderful and your wife comes back and your girlfriends and your kids and your boss is going to give you a $1 million bonus for signing back on because you're sober. You walk around whistling, you know, whistle while you work and you woke up this morning and Bambi's in your backyard. I don't know. Well, Bambi ain't in my backyard. Him and Thumper and Flower ain't been out there. And you know what happened is I stood out there and I started crying, and all the things I'd done to my mom and dad growing up, the little nickel and dime things, the chinchy things we don't think about, the lying and the shoplifting and the crap came down and sat on my chest, and I thought I was going to die from a heart attack, and I can't go to AA because I don't want to take a drink. Where do you go when you want to commit suicide? You see, I quit drinking. I hadn't had a drink in 90 days, and I want to kill myself. Where do you go? And you guys said you got to go if you want to go to AA, if you want to take a drink, come there. And I don't want to drink. And then all the things I'd done to 2 wives and 4 kids and when I was a cop in Vietnam, and it's choking me out, and I'm just suicidal as hell. Where do I go? What do I do when I'm not drinking and I feel this pressure and this desperation and this craziness that's inside of me, and where do I go? See, you didn't tell me. And, you know, I didn't go to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings for a year. You see, I didn't want to take a drink. And I got to tell you, if you're an alcoholic like me and you quit drinking and you get desperate and crazy, what happened to me might happen to you. I don't know. I don't know what kind of drunk you are. But you see, I come back to California and I got those wife and kids back, and we didn't have anything but my stolen car, and we moved into a garage in the middle of a vacant field. And we slept on the floor of that garage, and we ate out of a styrofoam chest, and we put water on our cereal. And we had to plant a garden to eat and stuff. And I was still lying, cheating, and carrying on, and I was still hanging out in the bars drinking club soda with a twist of lime, you understand, because I like the music and the intellectuals that hang out there. And I hadn't changed anything. I was using obscene, profane, vulgar language around my kids, and I was browbeating that family. And I got worse than I ever was drinking, my wife said. And I got to tell you what happened to me, because it might happen to you if you don't come into these meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, get involved in these home groups, get yourself commitments, and do what the winners are doing, because what happened to me might happen to you. I'm 6 months without a drink of alcohol. I've been 6 months. We're living in that garage. I'm still crazy. I'm still carrying a gun. I still got a foul mouth, and I'm on the freeway driving. I ain't been to any meetings of AA because I don't want to drink. And this guy in front of me is going 55 in the fast lane, and I honked at him and told him to move over, and he didn't. And I honked again and told him to move out of the way, and he didn't. Now, I don't know about you, but that makes me crazy, and so I rear-ended him. And I chased him off the freeway, and I'm still carrying a gun. And he drove off the freeway, and I got out of my car, and I walked up to his, and I put the gun inside his car. And I said, if you ever drive that slow again, I'll kill you. And I put the gun away. At that point in time, I didn't want a cold beer. I wasn't thinking about having a beer. I was thinking about blowing his head off. So I can't come to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings because I don't want to drink. I got back in my car and drove off. And I still ain't been to any meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm 10 months without a drink of alcohol. And I'm standing in a grocery store. I collected up some pop bottles, and I'm getting myself some Pepsi and some cigarettes. You don't think I'm going to get my kids milk for their cereal, do you? Because I'm selfish. I'm self-centered. I'm a taker, for Christ's sakes. I always think of me first. Me, me, me. I am the mighty I am. And I don't care about you, I'm getting mine. And so I'm in the grocery store getting me my stuff, and I'm standing there in line with my Pepsi and cigarettes, and the sign says 10 items or less, cash only. And I'm standing there, and my head clicks in and says, count that lady's items. And I count the items, and she's got 13 items. Now, where in the hell do you draw the line at? Do you let her have 11? Can she have 11 items if they're hooked together or something? Can she have 12? I feel pretty good that day. She can have those 13 items, and I'm just grinding inside. And then she breaks a checkbook out. And I said, wait a damn minute. I said, you need to read that sign, lady. It says cash. You're not writing no check. And she turned to me, and she said, I'll be through in a minute, sonny. I've never been a sonny. I wasn't going to be a sonny that day either. And I told her, you're not writing that damn check. You need to read that damn sign. And I started throwing her groceries on the floor and said, you ain't doing it. Now, maybe when you stop drinking and you don't come to meetings, you can handle that stuff like that. I can't handle that. It just made me crazier than hell, and they call the sheriffs on me. Can you believe it? And the sheriffs come in, Los Angeles County sheriffs, and they say, have you been drinking? I said, no, I haven't been drinking. I haven't drank for 10 months. I said, she's violating the store laws, and I used to be a cop. And all they said was, step outside, Deputy Jones. And that's how I get when I don't go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I feel pressure and anxiety, and I got crazy. And then at 13 months without a drink of alcohol, no meetings of AA, I'm in this office there in Newhall, California, and this guy walks by and he says, hey, Frank, how you doing? Now, that's a personal question. And I hate people prying into my private life. And I'm going to tell him how I'm doing, but I don't want anybody to know. And so I grabbed him by the throat, and there was a partition between us, and I jerked him over onto the desk, and I started choking him, saying, how the hell do you think I feel? And what happened to me might happen to you if you don't come to these meetings, okay? I flipped out. And it ain't all bad, okay? It's kind of mellow. You're not worried about IRS or anything. It's just, you're just there, and it's kind of calm. I think it's serenity is what they call it. And some guys pulled me off, and they pried my hands off his throat. And I got to tell you, there was a God in the office that day, because in that office that day happened to be an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he laid this card down, and he said, I know what's wrong with you, but he said, I can't help you. You need to call this guy. He said, I'm afraid of you. And so they took me back to the garage I was living in, and they collected up my guns, and I had a hand grenade and debt cord. I was waiting for the war. And they took all that stuff away from me, and they sat with me because I had flipped out, and they sat with me for about 10 days. And they took me down to see this man, and I sat in his office and I cried. You see, I just sat there and cried, and what that man explained to me has saved my life and sanity up to and including tonight. Because what he told me sitting in his office, he says, right now you don't have a problem drinking. He said, right now you have a problem living. And he says, you need to find a living answer to your living problem. And he says, you'll find it in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, if you go to meetings of AA, there's a group of people that's already been down that road before you. And all you got to do is fall in behind them and get with them and go and do what they're doing. And you'll never have to feel the way you do right now. He says, but your problem is living, and you need to come into AA. You need to get the big book and start reading it. He said, you need to read the black part, not the white. And he said, start at page one. He told me I needed to have a higher power. And I said, I don't believe in God. And he said, somebody hangs a moon out at night and they take it down in the morning. Pray to whoever that is. I said, all right. He told me I needed to get commitments at the meetings because the commitments will be mine and the meeting will be mine. And I've always wanted to feel a part of it. And he said, if you go and get a commitment, you take the trash out or you wash the coffee pots or you clean up or sweep up the outside, that you'll feel a part of that meeting. And you'll have to go check on it to be sure the secretary's running it right. And he said, a commitment means you show up unless there's a death in the family and it's yours. I understand that kind of talk. And he told me I needed to call him every day. And I, you know, to this day, I can tell you this, that any direction my sponsor's given me, I've never questioned him on it. You see, he's never given me any advice that's hurt me. He told me, he said, if you ever have a question on what I'm telling you, just go do it. When you get done, come back and see me, and I'll tell you why you had to do it. And to this day, I've never had to go back and ask him why I had to do something. You know why? By the time I got through doing it, I see the results. It was to make me feel better. And it was to help another alcoholic. He told me to come into these meetings and shake hands. He told me to sit in the front row and shut up and listen. He told me don't get up and wander around a meeting when the meeting's in progress, because he says there may be somebody newer than you that wants to hear it. And if you're up parading around, it distracts him. And we don't care whether you go out, but we want the newcomer to stay. And you know, I understood that. And he said, that's respect for Alcoholics Anonymous. And he told me I needed to make Alcoholics Anonymous first in my life. He said, as long as you've got AA first, you've got a chance to have a wife and kids and a job and the rest of that stuff. But unless you put AA first, you're not going to have anything, because he says you're going to lose it just like before. And you know, I came into the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous like that man told me to do. And I sit in the front row and I took the cotton out of my ears and I put it in my mouth and I started to listen. And I started to watch you, because all of us can rap a fat game. I've always been able to rap a fat game, but you see, I watched how you treated each other in here. You see, I don't know how to treat people. I don't know how to act. And I watched you, how you treated your wives and your girlfriends and your kids. And, you know, deep down, I wanted to do that because I've never been able to. And you know what you told me? You said, go home and tell your wife and kids you love them. And I said, I don't love them. And they said, well, go home and lie to them. You've been lying to them for 10 years. You see, you told me you didn't care what I thought. I just had to go take the action. And, you know, I went home and I started telling those wives and kids that I loved them. And I didn't love them. I could have cared less about them. I was consumed with me. I'm important, not them. I'm the one trying to get sober. Can't you see? I'm trying. I'm working. And I went home and told them I loved them, and I didn't. And after a long time, one day I told my kids I loved them, and something funny happened. I loved them. It's the damnedest thing. I did it long enough that I talked myself into it. I don't know how this works. You know, and then my kids, they used to duck when I walked by, and it took, I was 3 years sober. My one daughter at home now, she's 16. I was 3 years sober before she ever told me she loved me or hugged me. She was so frightened of me. She used to duck every time I walked by. And I used to tell her I loved her, and she'd just look at me. And I had devoided her of any feelings with my actions and yelling and screaming at her when she was 2 and 3 years old, and she didn't forget. And after the third year, one day she come up, and I was getting ready to go to a meeting, and we moved out of that garage into a house, and that little girl crawled up into my lap, and she put her arms around me, and she said, I love you. And that feeling I got that day, you can't get that out of a bottle of booze, you see. And you folks did that for me. I didn't do it. I'm not a wonderful husband or father. You know, but what I've learned to do is I've learned how to act better than I feel. I've learned how to treat people more than what I want to treat them, you know. And I didn't know any of those things until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, the things just started to change in my life. And I started to care about other people. And I asked my wife how her day went. And I didn't care. But you guys told me to ask her, simulate interest in her. And, you know, I didn't care how her day went. I wanted to tell her about my day, you know. And one day I asked her how her day went, and she started to tell me, and I listened to her. And it's kind of funny that what you did is you made me turn my eyes out from me and to start looking at other people. And I didn't want to do that. And I don't always want to do it today. But you see, I found out by working those 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's a set of tools for me that I can use to rebuild myself from the inside out and to clean myself up. And I didn't know that. And I have to take those home with me. And I have to take them out in that world with me, because in here it's easy to be wonderful. In here it's easy to love you and hug and shake hands and kiss and all that crap here. It's hard to do it out there. That's where I have a tough time. They don't do it right. And they don't care that I'm sober. And they don't care how angry I get. You see, but in here I find comfort, and I find peace, and I find happiness, and I find laughter. And in here I find the answers to my problems. And you're going to hear, and if you're new tonight sitting in here, and You hear people say, just bring the body and the mind will follow. Bring the body and the mind will follow. Bull! Don't listen to people that tell you that. Because that don't work. You can't just come in here, sit and do nothing and get this. This is a program of into action. You gotta do something when you get in here. If you get in here and take, you're a loser. You gotta be a giver. That's what I was told when I got here. You gotta give to get. And the more you put into the 12 steps, the more you're gonna get back in harmonious living out there. And I didn't know that. But if you think you can just get by sitting in here on your fat duff, what you need to do is go home tonight, get in your garage, think about being a car. If you turn into a car, drive back to the hotel tomorrow and tell me I'll honk your horn. You can't do it. You see? This is a program of action, and you got to do it. You got to get things going in here. You got to work. The 12 steps are there for a reason. I didn't know that. They said you got to work the 12 steps. Jones in order. That's why they numbered them. Start out at number one, end up at number 12. That's it. Have commitments. And I did that. You know, I started doing these things. The life changed. We moved out of the garage. We got a house. I got a job as a security guard, for Christ's sakes. I don't know how to be anything. That's beneath my station. I used to be something. I can't make $4 an hour, for Christ's sakes. And my sponsor said, how much are you making now? I said, nothing. He said, hell, that's an improvement. Take the job. And you know, I've done a lot of things I don't want to do that go against my thinking. But you see, I got here and found out my thinker's broke. I wanted a lot of things when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, and all the things I wanted, I ain't got any of them. What I've got is just what I've needed, to get by. I've just had the toughest year of my sobriety. I just spent a year unemployed, and I got a daughter in law school. My kids are great, but I got a daughter in law school in her last year. I got a daughter that's a senior in college, and I got my all-time favorite 16-year-old at home. She's a junior in high school, and you know, and I want to help the kids, and you can't, and that hurts your ego, and it hurts your self-worth when you can't contribute to the family. And my sponsor says, make looking for a job, and so 6-7 hours a day, I'm pounding the pavement. I'll take a job as a forklift driver, a garbage man. I'll pick crap with the chickens. I don't care. And I couldn't get hired, and we had a terrible year, and we almost went down the tubes, and it's as bad as it's ever been. And, you know, a drink wouldn't have changed it. A drink wouldn't have changed anything. It would have made it worse. And what I did is I kicked my meetings up, and I got a commitment. I started working with new people. And I started going on panels, and I started doing Alcoholics Anonymous, because this is what saves my life, see? This is where I get the help. I didn't come in here and get loans from everybody and do all that. What I come in here is to get spiritually fit. I use Alcoholics Anonymous the way I used to use alcohol. And it works. You see? Because I didn't get suicidal and crazy. And I got through the hard times, and on September the 20th, I ended up with a job. And I feel like I'm in the Witness Protection Program. It's something I don't even know anything about. I've never done anything. I've never worked in a refinery before. I'm a cop and security and a bodyguard and all of that. And I'm working in an oil refinery, for Christ's sakes. Operations, testing jet fuel and stuff. I was afraid to get on the airplane this morning. I test the jet. Figure that out. I looked at the lady sitting next to me and her husband. I said, you know what? The jet that's on this airplane, we pipe it directly to LAX from the company I work for. I said, do you know who tested the jet fuel on here? They said, who? I said, me. I've been there 48 days. I said, you know what's in my bag? They said, what? I said, a parachute. But you see, Alcoholics Anonymous works, and it works good. And you know, bad things happen when you get sober. We get sober and it ain't a rose garden and everything's going to go our way and people care. And you're not going to hit the lottery. You may or you may not. But you know, bad things happen. 4 years ago, my dad died, and I love my dad, and he had Alzheimer's and a blood clot on the brain, and he died, and it crushed me, and I didn't want to go back there and cry and make a spectacle of myself in front of my brothers and my mom and the family, and some old-timers in my home group told me, why don't you go back and thank your mom rather than yourself? She was married to him for 50 years, and you know, I'm still self-obsessed. And so I had to do that, and I took AA back there with me, and I supported my mother. And you know, I loved my dad, and when he died, I was clean with him. We were even. And he loved me and I loved him. And you know, I got mad at God, and you know that God didn't say, I think I'll just do this to Frank Jones. My dad died because he was old and he had Alzheimer's and a blood clot on the brain. You see, God don't punish me. You know, I have choices today and it's life and bad things happen. I lost a business in sobriety and my wife went through some illness and things have happened with me and, you know, but that's life. And what we learn here is how to live life and accept it. And there's good and there's bad and we got to just go on with it. But on the bottom line, when you equal everything out, it's the best life I ever had, you see. I come into Alcoholics Anonymous. I just wanted to just get the craziness out of my head. Instead, I got three lovely daughters. I got a son that's a muck. Can you believe that? My son's a muck. He's been in and out of prison for the last 8 years. He spent 4 years, got out, went back to prison, got out, went back to prison. He's an alcoholic. He's violent and angry. I don't know where in the hell he got it at. You know, Jesus. I just, you know, and he was sober. He's off parole, and he had been sober a year, and he's back out now. And I got a call from LAPD homicide yesterday, and he was involved in a murder, and there's a contract out on his life. And you know, I can't change that. You know what I have to do? I have to stay here and be an example. You know, I'm powerless over that, and I learned that here from you people. You see, do I worry about him? Do I love him? Yeah. Yeah, I do. But you know what? I can't force him in here with us. My sponsor said, you know, he has a God in his life the same as you do, and it'll work in God's time, not yours. And he said, maybe he won't get here. And you know, maybe he won't. I don't know. But you know what? Me stopping going to meetings, me not doing what I'm committed to doing AA ain't going to change that. Me mistreating my family ain't going to change that. Me not going to work ain't going to change that. What I need to do is continue to do what's in front of me. I need to suit up and show up. You know, my daughter's in law school and a daughter in college. My daughters love me and my son loves me. And, you know, I love my kids unconditionally, whether they're successful or they're not. They're my kids. And you know, I did the best I could raising them. And today I'm trying to be an example. And you know, I got here and I wanted to be a macho tough guy. I wanted to be this badass. I wanted everybody afraid of me and the women flocking to me. And I wanted to make a lot of money and have a big job. And I got here and I found out I have a primary purpose. That's not any of those things. My primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics. That's it. That explains it to me. He told me that. He said, keep it simple. Your primary purpose, Frank, is to stay sober and help other alcoholics. Okay, thank you. Now I don't have to figure that out anymore. And now about being macho, you guys ruined that for me a long time ago. Being macho, I come in here, you know what you guys told me? Hank was in my group when I got here, for Christ's sakes. Being macho is driving a car with a driver's license. What? That ain't macho. Cheating the law is macho. No, driving a car with a driver's license. Having car insurance when you're driving a car, that's macho. Treating your wife and kids and other people the way you want to be treated, that's macho. Not using obscene profane language, that's macho. Getting a job where they take taxes out and it's not some oil scam and taking people's savings. Having a job where they take taxes out and give you a check, that's macho. Coming to meetings, staying late and coming in early. When you represent AA, wear a tie and a jacket, that's macho. Every picture you see of Dr. Bob and Bill there in a tie and a suit. Why am I better than them? I'm not. I do what my sponsor tells me and you people tell me. You see, that's macho. Sticking out your hand when a newcomer needs help, that's macho. Never having to validate yourself, that's macho. Since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had to use anybody or anything to validate me. I feel like a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the first time. And I haven't had to use anything but that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, my sponsor in this program, to feel like a man. And a man is somebody that can cry and laugh and show his emotions and be true. And I didn't know that. And if you're new or used tonight, you don't have to listen to anything I've said because it's not important to you. It's important to me. It's important to me. I need to know what I used to be like and how very fortunate I am to have even got here. And what it's like for me today, and I have a very good life. I have peace. I didn't wake up today in a wet bed. I didn't throw my dinner up when I ate it. I know where I'm going to be tonight, and I know where I'm going to be tomorrow. My kids expect me home. I haven't done anything today that I can't let my mom watch me do. And I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous that is active in the program, and I do the things I'm supposed to do. If you're new or used, there's a portion in that big book, and it's in chapter 5. And if you're new or used tonight, the only thing you need to remember is that very first line of that chapter 5, and it says it all. And if you do that, I think you're going to be safe. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Thanks for having me.